We are.
All right. Good morning. This is case A19-1556, Francis Stephen Gill versus Gretchen Zwocken Gill. Presiding is Judge Jeffrey Bryan. Judge Johnson and Judge Cochran.
Morning. Before we begin, I'd like us all to make sure that we are able to hear each other. So why don't I start with the judges on the panel. Judge Johnson, are you able to hear everything that Carla and I have been saying?
Yes.
Great. And I can hear you as well. Judge Cochran?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me all okay? Right. I don't have my headset with me today.
I hear you loud and clear.
Great.
Okay, Mr. Al-Ghazawi.
Yes.
You're able to hear the three judges?
I hear all three judges, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Eisness?
Yes, I do. I hear everybody. Everybody hear me?
All right, yep. Wonderful. We do, first of all, I want to thank you for being able to participate today in this WebEx oral argument. It's difficult times, but I appreciate everybody's flexibility. I do want to make a note that as you're kind of toggling through the different ways to view the screen, there is a way to view just the person who's talking, or there's a way to view everybody at once. And I say that because the marshal today will also be showing on her screen the time that you have available. So if you're clicking into the view where you can see all the squares at the same time, then you should be able to see very clearly the time that remains for your arguments. If, however, you're doing the active speaker view, then sometimes folks aren't able to see the timer. With that being said, are counsel prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Yes, we are.
All right. And as I noted before, we do have the timer. So before you begin, if you would just state clearly your name and let the marshal know, we typically will reserve the 5 minutes for rebuttal. But if there's something else that you would like us to do, just let us know, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alan Eidsmus. I am the attorney for the appellant Gretchen Gill. And I would like to reserve just 5 minutes for my rebuttal. I know in today's world, which is turned upside down, the issue before you may not seem all that important because both parties do have significant assets. But what is important is that every case be decided pursuant to the law and within the established principles in the law, as fairly as possible. That is all my client and I are asking of the court today. My client is not a rapacious litigant, as argued by the respondent in his brief. All she has ever asked for is an equal division of the marital assets accumulated over a 21-year marriage in which she had four children with her husband, and in which her husband testified at trial that she was an integral part of his business background, an integral part of the creation of marital assets. This case has been in the appellate courts twice, first before this court and second before the Supreme Court. This court, at my client's appeal, reversed the trial court judgment which said that these earnouts payments, which are the focus of the appeal, are non-marital. The Court of Appeals made short shrift to that argument and said, no, they are marital assets. Mr. Gill, not my client, Mr. Gill appealed to the Supreme Court and his appeal was denied. The trial court and the Court of Appeals were affirmed. The earnouts are marital assets. Now on remand, in which the district court was requested to equitably divide the assets of the earnouts once they were determined, the trial court persisted in its view that Mr. Gill was entitled to more than 50% of that asset. And that's why we are here today, because that decision was an abuse of its discretion and a failure to follow the directives of the Supreme Court decision. The basic facts in this case are not disputed. Parties during their marriage acquired an interest in Talenti, which was a gelato company, and they owned 38.7%, basically, through the auspices of a LLC called Windmere. Actually, they owned 80% of that 37.5%, and the four children owned the remaining 20% through trusts that they were set up during the marriage by their parents. Talenti was acquired by Unilever, and all members of—
Counsel, I'm going to jump in here because I think the panel is well aware of the facts, given the posture of this case. I have some questions, though, about the arguments that you're making that the district court did not follow the Supreme Court's mandate in this case. And I don't mean to push you along, but maybe it'd be useful to address exactly what you think the Supreme Court told the district court to do and how you think the district court disregarded that.
Surely. The Supreme Court said to the district court, go ahead and make an equitable division of these marital assets. But it said you must follow the language of the statute, 518.58, and which the Supreme Court said specifically, you must conclusively presume that each party made a substantial contribution to the acquisition of income and property while living together as husband and wife. Counsel for respondent argued to the district court that it should basically disregard the Supreme Court's decision because
if the instruction is to do as the statute says, which is to presume that an equitable division is an equal division of assets for the period of time when the parties were living together, aren't district courts allowed to in a sense, disregard the valuation date when dividing property and not follow that presumption when dividing property if there are contributions that one party makes after the parties are no longer living together?
If the value changed after they were no longer living together before the divorce took place, but the value didn't change. The value was set at the time the sale took place because this court has already held and the Supreme Court has held that the value was set at that time. And the fact that one party may have worked post-divorce, post-separation, does not comply with the statute. There's nothing in the statute that says a party's work after the divorce has any indication as to the valuation and division of a marital asset.
So how does, or what was the value of the earnouts? What was the dollar value of the earnouts at the time of the purchase of Talenti?
The value was found by this court and affirmed by the Supreme Court was between zero and $170 million, make a total purchase price of $350 million. That was the and value.
Zero to 170 is a wide range. What went into determining exactly where along that range the earnouts would be?
It was the performance of Talenti as a whole. As the Supreme Court wrote in its opinion, there was not one party who caused the increase in value or caused any valuation between zero and 170. It was the achievements of the company as a whole. Mr. Gill was paid separately for his work. He negotiated his own contract. He was paid separately for that. But the increase in value was the work of the company as a whole. Now, the trial court said it couldn't have been done without Mr. Gill. But remember, the Supreme Court said that the trial court should have made its decision on how to divide the assets as of the time of trial. As of the time of trial, Mr. Gill had not done his work to try and increase the value of the asset. None of the Talenti people had done their work because the earnout was not completed by the time of trial.
Mr. Eisness,
Yes.
So I'm looking at the Supreme Court's opinion, and I think I've identified the paragraph that I think is the source of the law that governs your argument. Is it the paragraph that begins, here the district court should have determined the appropriate percentage of earnout payments that would be allocated to Stephen and Gretchen only if and when such payments are paid to Windmere, citing Janssen, which cites the Illinois Hunt case. I mean, I think if I'm understanding your argument, that's exactly where the Supreme Court gave direction to the district court, and that's what you're talking about now. Am I correct there?
You are absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well then, how did the district court, can you be more specific, please? How did the district court fail to apply that directive of allocating or determining the appropriate percentage?
Because it looked at the work that Mr. Gill did after the divorce. At the time of the divorce, Mr. Gill hadn't done the work.
But only in small part, right? Excuse me for interrupting, but only in small part, a small fraction. I mean, she received, if I remember correctly, half of 7/8 of one earnout payment and half of 7/9 of one of the other earnout payments. So really a very slight deviation from a 50-50 split. I think is she got 40 some percent of the earnout payments, correct?
That's correct. She got $4.7 million less than he did. Mm-hmm. And she was the only person who was an owner of DGG, the holding company that sold to Lenti. She was the only person that paid anything to Mr. Gill for all of his services. If his services were so valuable, why did none of the other members have to be charged with any of his services? As the Supreme Court said, what has happened is Mrs. Gill is being treated differently, and that result was perverse at the time it was determined that it was non-marital asset.
Am I correct in characterizing it as she's being treated differently only with respect to that period after the valuation date, or perhaps a better way, or after the dissolution date? But in other words, she's being treated the same with for 7/8 or 7/9 of the earnout payment. It's just that there's a period of time after the parties have gone their separate ways where for a fraction of the earnout payments, he's getting the benefit of his efforts for that period of time. I mean, that's my understanding, and I'm perhaps characterizing it, but I invite you to tell me why that characterization is incorrect.
Well, for two reasons. One, the trial court, when it makes a decision, a discretionary decision as to what is an equitable distribution, must look at the facts as of the time of trial. You can't look at the facts of what's going on in the future. And Mr. Gill spent at least a year after the trial was over, and both years after they separated, doing things that benefited everybody except Mrs. Gill. And the argument
also, is... Also, you said you need to look at the facts as of the time of trial. At the time of trial, wasn't it clear under the terms of this business transaction that Mr. Gill would be running the company for 2 years? So why wasn't it appropriate for the district court then to consider that in determining an equitable distribution?
Because those services were rendered after the time to make the decision about the equitable distribution of marital assets. Those actions were taken subsequent to their valuation date, subsequent to their divorce. And the statute doesn't allow the court to say efforts after the divorce. All the statute says, 518.58, is these efforts during the marriage. Now they're after the marriage. And the Supreme Court said the asset was acquired during the marriage. And what the trial court did is tried to look at it and say the earnouts were really acquired after the marriage. But they were acquired as part of the sale, the contractual right to receive the earnouts. That's the key asset that's being acquired, not the earnouts themselves.
Isn't the key point that the Supreme Court is making is that you have to treat the earnouts as an asset, as a marital asset, as opposed to non-marital. And then it's up to the district court to try to divide that asset. And in doing so, it is proper, as I stated earlier, I think, under the statute, to consider efforts that post-date the valuation date, right?
Not as I read the statute, because it says the efforts post-dating the valuation date relate to the acquisition of non-marital property. Once the valuation date has been set, the marital property is no longer to be created.
We're not talking about the creation of property. We're talking about the division of it. And isn't it proper for a district court in any asset? Let's say it's a house that is to be divided upon emancipation of the youngest child at some point in the future. Isn't it proper for the district court at that point to consider efforts of one party in maintaining the asset or increasing its value post the valuation date, indeed even post the dissolution date? Isn't it proper for a district court to look at what that might be and consider what that contribution would look like, and excluding the presumption that only applies while the parties are living together? Wouldn't it be proper for the court to arrive at a percentage of division of that house that is in consideration of one party's efforts post-valuation date and indeed post-dissolution date?
I lost everybody for a moment. I don't believe so, Your Honor, because typically in a case like that, the court would have said at the time of the dissolution, you're going to divide the proceeds either 50-50 or 60-40 or 70-30, whatever you're going to do.
But well, would it be improper for the district court at that time to say we're going to divide the proceeds of the house based on a numerator that is the total years that the parties together maintain the house, and a denominator that is the entire total years that either party has the right of possession for the house? In other words, an analogous to Janssen or analogous to the 7/8 and 7/9?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because Janssen applies to determination marital property and non-marital property. It doesn't determine how to divide marital property. And to try and figure out during a period of time when someone owns a house, whether they've done the right thing to make it increase in value, whether the market increased the value. So typically in my cases that I've dealt with over my years, the trial court would say, we're going to divide that asset when it's sold and a certain percentage already determined. Now, obviously if someone burned the house down, that might make a difference, but not in a typical case. And I see my time is just about up.
Could I, Judge Bryan, ask one more question, even though time is expiring?
Of course, go ahead.
Mr. Eidsness, could I please turn your attention to the addendum, page 63? I'll wait until you tell me you have that in front of you.
I don't have that particular page in front of me, Your Honor, but tell me what the document is. I probably have the document here.
This is the amended order of the district court, and in part XLI, so that would be part 16, the district court made extensive, it seems to me, amended findings or new findings, 4 or 5 pages long, about the events. And this seems to be to making findings about things that occurred. I'm reviewing it now. I think some things that might have occurred after the party's dissolution was final, after the valuation date and so on. I mean, are you I guess my basic question is, are you challenging any of those findings, or are your legal arguments tantamount to saying that the district court engaged in incorrect fact-finding or considered the wrong issues in the course of that analysis?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at that finding, XLI, you can see where in this finding, the court basically disregarded what the Supreme Court said.
And how is that?
It says in the 1, 2, 3, about 7th line down, the court has factored wife's interest in DGG in determining the equitable division of the earnouts and the statutory factors, including the fact that the statutory presumption cited by the Supreme Court does not apply based on the party separation date. Why would the Supreme Court have specifically said that statute applies and that presumption applies, and now the district court says, well, it doesn't apply? he has totally disregarded that provision in the Supreme Court's decision, where it lays out the factors and specifically says you must take that factor into account in footnote 13 of the opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisness. Counsel for respondent, go ahead.
My name is Kareem El-Ghazawi. I represent respondent Stephen Gill, along with Michael Cerisi. I'm the only attorney present for today's argument. I think we need to really take a long, hard look at this case that's been going on for 6 years. We have a situation where this court, as well as the Supreme Court, remanded to Judge Robin for an equitable division of the asset. Judge Robin had initially made a determination that the assets earned from the earnouts were essentially non-marital. This court, the Supreme Court, took the position that it was a marital asset. And when you look at page 19 of the Supreme Court's decision, it states quite clearly, to the extent that the district court may consider one spouse's efforts and control over marital assets, it considers those facts when equitably dividing the marital assets, not when classifying particular property as non-marital. And it goes on to note that we apply the concept of the factors within the statute, as well as the efforts made by Mr. Gill. And during the trial, it was very clear that Mr. Gill would make very, very significant efforts, because the range was from zero to 170 million. It was clear from all of the findings made by the court during the initial trial, none of which were overturned, requests were made by Mr. Eitzness to overturn those findings, that Mr. Gill's efforts would be absolutely critical to the creation of that wealth. That wealth did not exist at the time that the purchase agreement was entered into. It was a mere potentiality. The statute is clear that there's a presumption when the parties are cohabitating as husband and wife. That ends when the parties separate. And that's exactly what the court did here. And you can see the internal inconsistency of the argument, where Mr. Eitzness now, for the first time, takes the position that all of Mr. Gill's efforts were non-marital with respect to an asset that the court, that our Supreme Court, has classified as marital. That's a staggering inconsistency. So we need to really think through, what discretion does Judge Robin have? And it's very interesting that during...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think there is a potential legal question as well, not just a discretionary one. The legal question is, there's two parts to it. Number one, is it proper to use a Janssen-type formula for apportioning marital property, or is Janssen limited to deciding whether something is marital or non-marital? What portions of a pension are marital versus non-marital? The second legal question for me is, under what circumstances can a district court look to post-valuation and post-dissolution efforts in deciding how to apportion marital property? The value of that property is set at the valuation date, but whether a district court can look to it. And then, of course, in this case, was there something about the Supreme Court's mandate that restricted the district court's ability on those two legal questions? So perhaps you could address those, starting with the Janssen point. Can a district court or any court use the Janssen formula or something like it to divide marital property? For example, I'll use the example I gave earlier about a house. Let's say that the parties have lived together in this house for 7 years. Their youngest child will be emancipated in 2 years. So the right of possession post-dissolution, let's say, is two more years to one party. Would it be improper for the district court to apportion that upon the sale, which wouldn't happen until emancipation, but apportion it based on a 7/9 fraction, sort of importing this analysis from Janssen to divide the house?
Well, I think the remand to the district court was, do equity, do your perception of equity. And it's interesting that in its findings, Judge Robin references the fact that Mr. Eidsness himself had made the suggestion of applying Janssen to this case itself after the trial was over in his post-trial request for amended findings. Mr. Eidsness himself had made that application. So I think it's a reasonable use and it's a transparent use. And it meets the requirements of giving her a significant portion of the earnouts while acknowledging the significant work. And that was determined at trial.
Counsel, did Mr. Eidsness suggest applying the Janssen formula to marital assets or to distinguish between non-marital and marital?
Mr. Eidsness, it's addressed in the court's finding of fact. Mr. Eidsness suggested that application is an equitable resolution of the case from my perspective. And that's how Judge Robin perceived it as well when he states Mr. Eidsness himself concedes that he presented application of the Janssen formula. But I want to be clear here. One of the issues is this requirement of exactitude regarding 50-50 percent allocation of marital property. There is no statute that requires a 50-50 allocation. There is no case law that requires a 50-50 allocation. It doesn't exist. In fact, Mr. Eidsness recently in the Marks case, which I think Judge Johnson was on, made a similar argument. There's an absolute requirement for 50-50. It was an unpublished decision, which is appended to Mr. Eidsness's reply brief. This court denied that request. It made clear in the case, and I'll pull it out and give the exact cite, made clear, we are unaware of any case in which the Supreme Court has cited Miller as requiring an equal distribution. And Mr. Eidsness cites Miller for the proposition that it's appropriate in some cases to have an equal distribution. It's not appropriate in this case because 2 years of the life of Mr. Gill were taken up by trying to maximize the value of these earnouts. There was no responsibility on the part of Ms. Gill. The Supreme Court indicated that the statutory factor should be applied as well as Mr. Gill's efforts. And that's why Mr. Eidsness repeatedly tried to change the judge's findings of fact regarding the incredible efforts that Mr. Gill would need to pursue in order to obtain these earnouts. It was not a glide in the park. He had to overcome a lot of barriers. There was a lot going on. Now, Judge Robin, I think, did exactly what the Supreme Court asked him to do. He looked at the statutory factors and he concluded they were essentially equal between the parties. And then he looked at the efforts and he indicated that given those efforts, it's appropriate that there be some level of compensation. And I want to cite from-
Counsel, in doing so, though, did the district court, correct me if I'm wrong, but the district court ordered that for the 2015 amount, the wife was entitled to half of 7/8, correct?
That's correct.
And for 2016, she's entitled to half of 7/9.
That's correct.
And so basically, she was entitled to half up until the time of the divorce, up until 2014. But then for 2015 or 2016, she wasn't entitled to any portion of that. So does that basically transform the portion for 2015 and 2016 into non-marital interest because 100% is going to the husband, even though the court, Supreme Court said it is a marital asset?
I wouldn't take the position that 100% is going to the husband. The court allocated during those years 7/8 for 2014 and 7/9 for 2015, and she received that percentage allocation.
Just to clarify, I'm talking about for the 2015 and 2016 portions, though, right?
Yes, I'm sorry, I misspoke. for the 2015 and 2016, yes, he applied the formula, but it gave her significant, to put it a different way, all of Mr. Gill's efforts took place during those 2 years. And so she received a very, very significant portion of the work emanating from his efforts. It wasn't as if he had zeroed it out. Our position on remand was that he should receive the overwhelming majority of the earnouts because of his efforts and because of the fact that they took place during those 2 years.
Perhaps you can help us by telling us what the dollar amounts might have been if this had been a non-marital interest. As I look at this, the important part is that the denominator is still 9 years, right? It's not as if the district court said 50-50 of the initial 180 million sales price, and then beyond that, everything is non-marital. Therefore, 100% of the earnouts are non-marital. By my analysis, it seems, and I'll ask you to confirm this, it seems that if those are non-marital and he was getting 100%, or if the court were to convert it, then the amount that he would receive would be much greater. It would be basically the entire, his portion of the $125 million, $145 million total earnouts, that would be for him not 7/8 of his portion of that, but 100% of that. Is that fair? Maybe you can compare what a non-marital interest would have looked like to what he got when it came to 7/8 and 7/9.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that's exactly right. During the initial determination, essentially $29 million non-marital dollars would have gone to Mr. Gill for the 80% Windmere. Under this scenario, wife would receive about $12.4 million. So she increased and her position to by $12.4 million. And I do want to say this. Judge Robin, when he was presented with this, it has to be exactly 50-50. His response was, why was it remanded to be for an equitable determination? If it's 50-50, we just say it's 50-50 and it's done. That's not what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said, exercise your equitable discretion, and we accord broad, wide discretion to the district court judge. And that was asked by the judge. He asked Mr. Eisness, is your client's position instead that the Supreme Court sent this back to me telling me that even though it was remanded, it needed to be 50-50? Mr. Eisness responded like this, no, we never said it needed to be 50-50 on the remand, because I agree with Mr. Cerisi. If the Supreme Court wanted it to be 50-50, they could have said that. So it's very interesting to me that their entire brief is premised on the fact that the court abused its discretion, and there is not a single case in the state of Minnesota that requires an equal distribution. Even when the presumption is there and the parties are cohabitating together during the entire marital period of the allocation, the court can decide for any number of reasons. One spouse is achieving retirement and they're going to get 60%. And we have cases like Gumau and Batsell that address that very issue. It just seems the ultimate irony that at this stage in the game, it's conceded that the work all took place post-separation, and the statute accounts for that. And there's a reason, because we reward people by virtue of supporting one another in marriages. Once that support goes away, and it's not there, and it's presumptively not there, it's a whole different matter. Mr. Gill's efforts created this wealth. She received a very significant part of this wealth as a result of the Supreme Court's decision. And I don't think that under any theory, it could be viewed as an abuse of discretion. We have to conclude that Judge Robin abused his discretion in terms of making this allocation. And that's a very difficult road to hoe. Judge Brian, did I answer all of your questions? I know you had a multiple question, and if I have a few seconds left, I'd like to answer that for if there's anything I've missed.
Sure. So the application of Janssen to dividing marital property, you've referenced a couple of cases, and I'm curious to see if it's your interpretation of those cases that that's exactly what the court did, for example, in Gamow.
You know, Your Honor, I think the court viewed that as a reasonable application. And even if the application was improper, there's no harm done. It's harmless error. The court could have been affirmed if it had done a 70%, 30% allocation because it recognized the efforts of Stephen Gill. There is nothing in the Supreme Court decision that says the efforts of Stephen Gill have to be ignored. They're taking the position that once the potentiality vested on the purchase agreement, that number, which was unknown to everyone and which would require enormous work, is the number that she should get, equally divided. There is no support in Minnesota case law for that proposition, and none has been cited. Mr. Eitzness conceded as much during his hearing with Judge Robin.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eitzness?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me respond to some of the things that Mr. El-Ghazali said. First of all, the reason the Supreme Court remanded it back to the district court for an equitable distribution was at the time of the Supreme Court hearing, there was no record as to the factors under 518.58 because the trial judge had found the earnouts were all non-marital. Therefore, there was no need to make those findings. So the trial court judge did make those findings and said that all of the factors were essentially neutral, except for Mr. Gill's post-dissolution, post-separation efforts. So the real question here is, are those efforts allowed to be used to take away assets from a marital pot and divide them unequally when all the other factors are equal? Judge Bryan asked the question. Judge Bryan asked the question, can you look to post-valuation, post-separation efforts in dividing an asset? And the Supreme Court said, you should have made this decision, trial court, when the trial was held. And then those, what he was going to do in the future couldn't be known because it hadn't happened yet. And the Supreme Court—
Again, I'll ask the same question about the example of the house. Is it error for a district court to apportion or divide the house based on 7/9 if the parties lived together for 7 years in the house and then they were separated, the divorce happens, the valuation date, is it error for a district court to say in 2 more years, after 9 years of living in the house upon emancipation of the youngest child, I'll divide that 7/9 and the party who has right of possession for those extra 2 years gets a larger percentage. Is that error?
Depending upon the facts, I believe it is, Your Honor, because if the other party is paying spousal maintenance to allow the house payments to be made, why would you take away that party's interest in the house? And that's why I think in most cases, when you deal with houses, you would set at the time of the dissolution how those proceeds are going to be divided. Otherwise—
Right, but I'm saying at the dissolution, if the district court were to say, I'm going to divide it based on this Janssen-type formula, half of 7/9 as opposed to 50-50, you're saying that's still improper for a district court to do that?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I think it's an abuse of discretion because it's basically converting an asset that was divided into two factors, marital and non-marital. Exactly what Judge Robin did in this case by using the Janssen formula. And Mr. El-Ghazali can cite no case because no case exists that allowed the Janssen formula to be used as a basis to divide a marital asset. Janssen was designed to determine the difference between marital and non-marital. And I am taking a little umbrage at the argument by Mr. El-Ghazali that I raised this with the trial judge and his failure to be completely candid with this court. Judge Cochran was right. At the time I made that argument about Janssen, that's when, after the trial, the judge had determined 100% of the earnouts were non-marital. I argued in the alternative. I said, number one, that's wrong. They're all marital, which this court and the Supreme Court upheld. But number two, I said, even if you're right, Judge, that it's non-marital, there has to be some kind of an equitable division. And Janssen works right because that would relate to the marital time when people were together and non-marital time when they were not together. But that argument was rejected by the trial court. It was never made again. And now for him to argue, well, Janssen was raised by me and therefore Janssen must apply. It's just wrong. Janssen does not apply and there's no case law that would support that. Mr. El-Ghazawi cited the fact that the court said that in considering a spouse's efforts, there's nothing in the Supreme Court opinion that says that Judge Robin was to look at the efforts of Mr. Gill post-separation. He said to look at the efforts pre-separation. But the fact that the Supreme Court went on to say on that same page, the court cannot consider those efforts in isolation. It must base its equitable division on all relevant factors. Here, a relevant factor that must be considered is that Gretchen, Mrs. Gill, has a marital interest in Windmere's contractual right to receive the earn-out payments, a right received by all members who sold their ownership interest in David Goliath, regardless of whether they or their members contributed post-sale efforts to achieve earn-out payments. Everybody got their full share, except Ms. Gill. Mr. Gill got $4.7 million more with nobody else participating in that payment except my client. And Mr. El-Ghazawi said that was compensation to him. That's contrary to the Supreme Court decision that says these are not compensation. Mr. Gill was compensated for the work that he did. I'll conclude by saying under Nardini, the seminal case in Minnesota family law, Justice Mary Jean Coyne said, equity connotes fairness. That's what we're asking for here is fairness. 50-50 is fair, given that all the factors are neutral, except for the one factor the judge relied upon, which is outside the scope of the statute. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. The arguments were well-reasoned and the briefs are very well-written. I appreciate that. We will take this under advisement and issue an order within the relevant and pertinent timelines. Thank you very much.
Thank you.